Hi everybody. Just before we start our last event with a reading by Chip, I just wanted to say two things. One, thank you to all of you for coming and participating and listening and sharing and beginning to think about these questions with us and making the space together. I feel it's been a really nice atmosphere and we've all made that together, so thank you for that. And then secondly, I do have to say thank you obviously to all the tech team and all the backstage crew and everyone that's helped make this thing a kind of reality. So if we could give them a little round of applause. Thank you. And then of course, just a round of applause to our amazing guest, Samuel R. Delaney. It's been a total honor to host you.
I'm going to read you two things this evening. The first is a very short piece from a novel called The Madman. And it's narrated by an African-American who is notably younger than I am. And it takes place at 3 o'clock in the morning when he has just finished having public sex with an older African-American whom we know as Pops. And they're sitting on the bench in Riverside Park and basically they're more or less finished with the act and Pops begins to talk. "I was just remembering," Pops said, as I was about to get up and get up and walk on, "about the first time I ever got my dick sucked in this old park here. Shit, it must have been 20, no, more like 30 years ago. Maybe it was even 35. I was on the bum then, too. It was the first time I come in here. I don't know why I never came in here before, nor why I chose to come in here just then, but it was in the middle of the day, I remember. And I was sitting out in the sun on the benches, right down in front of one of them baseball diamonds they got down there away a bit. Some white guys was out there playing a baseball game. Most of them was white anyway. And while I was sitting there looking back at them over my shoulder every once in a while, or just watching the river like now, this kid come up to me, a little chink kid, 13, 14, slanty-eyed bastard, Chinese, I guess, or maybe Japanese. He came over to me and he said, 'Let me suck your dick.' Just about like you done this afternoon, except he wasn't a nigger like you and me, he was a chink. So I say, 'Okay, but where you gonna do it? I mean, them guys is playing baseball right back there.' And you know what he tells me? He tells me, 'That's all right. It don't make no difference. They come down here and play every week, and they won't see nothing.' And I say, 'What you mean they won't see nothing? They're right there playing baseball.' And this chink kid tells me, 'Look, there are two kinds of people in the world. There are baseball players and they're cocksuckers. And the baseball players just don't ever even see the cocksuckers.' Then he tells me, 'Besides, he done already sucked off four of the guys on the baseball team right where I'm sitting, and they wouldn't say nothing, even if they did see.'" Pop chuckled. "Smart little son of a bitch." "So then what happened?" I asked. "What do you mean?" "What, you let the kid suck you off?" "Yeah," I told him. "Go ahead." He pushed himself back against the bench. "That little slanty-eyed bastard was down between my knees, got a mouthful of my juice in a New York minute. Man, could that kid suck dick. Back then, of course, I never did take very long." The memory seemed to tickle him. "Of course, back then, too, sometimes I'd do crazy shit like that. I thought it was funny, letting some chink suck my dick in broad daylight with everybody right out in the park playing baseball. Guess I didn't know no better. But he was right. Nobody saw you or said nothing. They was all baseball players." Okay, now I'm going to read you something else that is kind of the sort of thing that makes encounters like that. That, by the way, is what happened. It makes encounters like that possible, or makes people seek them out. And this is from a nonfiction book called The Motion of Light in Water. And I'm going to read you two little sections from this that take place. One takes place when I was at summer camp, and the other one takes place in New York a few years later when I was 17. Let me see. Music was a hugely important ribbon weaving through our lives at Camp Woodland. That summer, I played the violin in the camp orchestra for a production of Herbert Hoffrich's cantata, We Come from the City, about a bunch of young city people who arrive in the Catskills to work on the Downsville Dam. That same year, in the back of a pickup truck with a tape recorder, Norman Kasdan, and half a dozen other campers, I rode through the countryside to collect songs and stories from local folk, shortly to be dispossessed from their neat homes, for their neat homes by the Lackawack Reservoir. The leafy light over the gray porches and white frame screen doors already suggested the water that would soon cover their sights to a depth of 40 feet. Wrapped through the evening, gathered in the stone amphitheater behind the recreation hall, we sat forward on our rocky seats, while down on the concrete platform, a log fire burning at its edge, Pete Seeger flailed out the Cumberland Mountain Bear Chase on his banjo. At the final twanging chord, he flung his fingers down the string so hard that two of his stainless finger picks flew off to spin, glittering among the first rows of literate listeners. At the same moment, a catch of water in the damp cement beneath the fire, burning an hour now, exploded like a gun crack, knocking over a log and sending cement bits clicking and furious sparks up 25 feet, swirling above Pete, turned to gape upward now, above the stage, above the trees, and into indigo evening. We all gasped, then applauded and laughed. I knew I had come to a magic place. My second year, at the 4th of July celebration on the ski slope, down the hill across the trestle bridge over the rocky and frothing Esopus River, I watched our new music counselor, Bob DeCormier, stand before the counselor's chorus, crowded together with their music on the performance platform's planks, knees together, thumbs and forefingers touching. Bob began to conduct out over campers and townspeople from Ellenville and Kingston and Bearsville and Woodstock and Phoenicia who'd come together for America's birthday. They sang, "The heart needs a brain, and the brain needs a heart, and the whole is greater than any one part." That same summer, under his direction, the Campers Chorus premiered DeCormier's profound and lyric cantata about the life and sayings of Sojourner Truth. And at my third year, I sang and danced the lead in another Hoffrich cantata, Boney Quillen, based on a local legend about a logger who ate his girlfriend's flowers when she went off with another man, who tricked his bosses and danced out the nights and carried his axe through the Catskill mornings. That summer, my favorite counselor was a slender, light tan woman named Mary. She had a mannish voice, and when we were assigned our parts in the chorus, she was pronounced, to some surprise, a tenor rather than soprano or alto. She sat next to me during chorus rehearsals all summer. Mary usually came to the Wednesday night social dances in jeans and short sleeves. When somebody made some comment and she finally consented to wear a skirt, I remember her, as we stood by the wooden wall, telling me, "I have a feeling I look very strange in this thing." She did. My family knew Mary's family, and on visiting day when Mom and Dad came up, my father asked her, surprised, "Why in the world did you cut all your hair off like that, young lady?" Jocularly, Mary answered, "Oh, the last time I was at the barber's, I fell asleep in the chair. When I woke up, he'd just gone on cutting, and it was like this." It was a rehearsed answer for an untoward question, but both my parents looked sad. Still, Mary listened patiently again and again while we sat at the old upright in Brooklyn College to my father's incomplete attempts that August to write my own cantata, and was even encouraging, which was more, I'm afraid, than the attempts deserved. All through those summers, professional musicians like Seeger and Louise Bennett came to make us music, and local musicians like Grant Richards sang to us about Bessie the Heifer, and aging Mike Todd played the harmonica and clacked his rhythmic rattling spoons in frantic chatter, stamping his boots as we listened, fascinated. Then, in my fourth year, suddenly I was in the older Woodland work camp further down the hill. Now, all the time, I was in and out of a building just up across the road, which I'd only glimpsed in previous years, called, beautifully and mystically, Butterfly Cottage. When I was 17, Uncle Miles and Aunt Dorothy came over one winter evening. My uncle's laughter and enthusiasm dwarfed everything and everybody in our house. "You gotta see this. Margaret, you're not gonna believe this. Sam," he meant my father, "it's right over there at the Apollo. They're female impersonators, but really, it's the cleverest thing you ever see." My mother's brother-in-law, Miles, a black judge, was just not usually so boisterous about such things, at least not when I'd seen him before. "That's the Jewel Box Review," my mother said. "Yes, I read about it." "Men dressed up like women," my cousin Barbara commented. "I think it sounds nasty. They're probably all fairies anyway." My aunt was saying, her voice undercutting her loud husband's, "You know, Margaret, the show in the first 10 rows of the theater was even stranger than what was going on stage." "I can believe it," Mother said to her older sister. "Well," Uncle Miles shrugged, "I don't know about that, but it's certainly entertaining. Everybody sings and dances in it. At the beginning, the master of ceremonies, this nice looking young fellow named Stormy, he's colored too, I think, and with a real fine tenor voice, tells you that the company is made up of 25 men and one real woman. Then the impersonators come out and sing and dance and do their numbers. Some of them are good, too. Not just because they look like women, either, though some, I swear, nobody could tell. Then you're supposed to see if you can figure out which one is real. Oh, I thought it was the cleverest thing." He turned again to my father. "And then, of course, at the end, it turns out..." "Now, don't tell," Aunt Dorothy said. "They might go see it."
"Oh," Uncle Miles laughed, "Sam and Margaret aren't going to go see anything like that. But at the end, Stormy, the master of ceremonies, comes out and asks the audience, which of the performers do you think is the real girl? And while people are calling out this name or that," he laughed again, "and everybody thinks they know it's this one or that one, Stormy pulls this thing that's been holding back his hair and shakes it out, and you realize she's been the real woman all along. It's right there at the Apollo." Barbara. Now, that's, now, that's not the usual sort of thing they have there, my father asked. Is that what they're doing there now? I don't like to go there, Aunt Dorothy said. The jokes the comedians tell are always so dirty. The company travels around, I guess, Uncle Miles said. That's just where they're playing while they're in New York. My father said. Now, why would they bring something like that there? No, my uncle protested again, laughing. It's really good. I stood in the living room like someone grown invisible, listening, wondering, puzzling that Uncle Miles, usually so staid, could grant his approval, even his enthusiastic approbation, to something so anarchic. At the same time, I yearned to see this transvestial extravaganza with a desire approaching the electric. Perhaps I would notice something, meet someone, recognize something in one of these strange people who'd clearly been marked as foreign and alien to everything I knew, that would in some way enlighten me about my own sexuality. I committed myself to seeing the show with the same desperation with which I had sought out Gide's Corydon and The Immoralist. Coming across me, reading it behind a book at my desk back in my freshman English class, Mr. Cotter had begun to thunder, "And what is it that's so important that you're reading it in here?" And on recognizing the title and the Nobel Prize-winning author, returned to his normal conversational tone. "Well, that probably is more important than anything I'm saying right now. You go ahead." The next Saturday, I strolled over to 125th Street and the fabled Harlem Theater, where regular movies alternated through the day and evening with live entertainment. This month's show, proclaimed the marquee, was indeed the Jewel Box Review. I paid the $5 for my ticket, half my month's allowance, went in and sat as close to the front of the orchestra as I dared, watching the last half hour of an unremarkable Western. The audience was mostly black, but a few white people had come, as though somehow this particular show transcended parochial racial interests. At the film's end, the lights came up on the stage, the first curtain swept back, and in purple sequins, a middle-aged black woman comic came out to regale the audience with a barrage of jokes far more sexually suggestive than I would have thought it was legal to tell from a public stage. Toward the end of her routine, which, vulgar as it was very funny, the orchestra players filed into the small pit. Then the music crashed up and out, another curtain swung back, and an amplified voice announced to the multiple balconies in the dark, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, what you've all been waiting for, the fabulous Jewel Box Review!" Why double my uncle's description with accounts of the glitter and feathers and sweeping trains in which the female impersonators danced with their male partners, a maleness suddenly thrust into quotation marks by the fake breasts, cinched waists, and wigs around it, for here all masculinity seemed as questionable as any femininity on show. Betuxed and black-tied, Stormy introduced Mr. Alberto Pavlova, who, in tutu toe shoes and silver wig, began to dance the dying swan, only to break out into something hot and kicky with a sudden lurch of the music toward jazz. Now, from the other side of the stage, Stormy introduced Mr. Georgie Brown, a hefty black transvestite who, in wig and high heels, with inch-long crimson nails, clutched a bit of sequined gauze to his padded bosom and sang day in, day out in a volcanic contralto that laid chills all down my shoulder blades. Once or twice,
someone in the first row ran to the footlights to hand a bouquet of roses up to one or another of the stately queens. And at the end, Stormy pulled loose her hair to let it fall over the tux's satin collar as the whole company came out to sing, "We're 25 men and a girl." Yet, as the curtain finally swept across the tinsel, plumes, and lamé, and the house lights came up briefly before the music began again, there seemed no way for me to break through the doubled and redoubled artificiality of this entertainment that had just made me laugh and thrill and madly applaud its falsifications, this one artful, that one pathetic, yet all insisting on the entire range of artifice that was art. It was dark in the street when, hands in my army jacket pockets, I strolled from under the bright marquee to walk back home. I never even mentioned to anyone in my family that I'd gone. It was some years later, when the jewel box had again made its annual swing through the Northeast, coming to light at the Apollo, that I overheard my mom and a downstairs neighbor talking in our kitchen. Certainly, I was curious, but, well, I couldn't have gone to see it, Mom said, putting down her coffee cup. You know how her mother feels about it. Really, she never would have spoken to me again if she'd found out. Now, that's the one I read about who plays the master of ceremonies, the neighbor's voice repeated and confirmed at once. The one they called Stormy. Yes, that's Mary. My mother nodded. Who used to be a counselor with Sam and Peggy at camp about 6 or 7 years ago? My mother nodded. That's right. And for a moment, and only a moment, it was as if a gap between two absolute and unquestionably separated columns or encampments of the world had suddenly revealed itself as illusory, that what I had assumed two was really one, and that the glacial solidity of the boundary I'd been sure existed between them was as permeable as shimmering water, as shifting light. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And if you are interested and you have access to Wikipedia, you can look up Stormy, who spelled her name Stormy de Lavoriere on Wikipedia, and she has a whole Wikipedia page. She died in 91. And mainly what she's remembered for is not being the person who went on to make the Jewel Box Review, but she's remembered almost primarily as being a hero of Stonewall. She's one of the people who threw the first punch at Stonewall. And she was quite a person. Yeah, okay, thank you.